Six music.
BBC Radio's Six Music documentaries, telling the stories in music that matter now.
My guest this week on The First Time is without doubt one of the most admired and gifted songwriters in the history of popular music. He arrived seemingly fully formed with his 1977 debut album, My Aim Is True, full of passion, anger and poetry, and he hasn't stopped moving since. He's produced albums of garage rock, lavish orchestral pop, country and western, R&B, easy listening, classical pieces, Tin Pan Alley ballads and jazz. In fact, the only thing that ties together his output are his brilliant lyrics and his songwriting skill. I'm very proud to say my guest here on The First Time this week is Elvis Costello. Not a man who does many interviews, quite possibly not a man who enjoys interviews. Here, Elvis talks about the influence of his father on his musical history. His father was a trumpeter with the Joe Loss Orchestra in the 50s and 60s. The recording of his breakthrough album, My Aim Is True, and enlisting legendary jazz trumpeter Chet Baker for his classic song Shipbuilding. He also talks about some of his favourite collaborators, who include Paul McCartney, Burt Bacharach, and most recently The Roots. But I started off by asking him, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
My mother says I was first aware. I've got you under my skin. Just by the, that was like a first word, and not say the first word, But and that's like, it came out the year I was born, so it could have been like within a year or so, like whenever you start speaking, I don't know.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, darling, I know so well I've got you under my skin. Sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near, in spite of the warning voice that comes in the night and repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time that I do, just a thought of you makes me stop. Before I begin, yes, I've got you under my skin.
Because it was obviously a musical household with your dad.
Yeah, and then, you know, so the first pop record I ever had in my possession, my dad gave to me because he had, I had shown an interest in it, and that was Please Please Me. Because he was learning it to sing it on the radio. He sang with Joel Austin on the broadcasts in the throughout the 60s. So as well as the sort of strict tempo romantic stuff that they sang in the dance hall, Latin stuff and so forth, you know, they also were on a show where they played the hits of the day, which was it's a curious thing that people don't really remember now, that you know, there wasn't 24-hour radio. There was nothing like it. There were only a few hours of radio a week where you could hear songs, you know. But so dance bands did as much as they weren't really the same right lineup, you know, to be playing many of these songs. They were playing them on these shows, and I grew up hearing for a few years hearing my dad learn those in the front room.
Party, 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 party
And that was Patsy Girl, an unlikely COD ska track recorded by Elvis Costello's dad, Ross McManus, which became a top 20 hit in Germany in 1964. Quite different from his work as a trumpeter with the Joe Loss Orchestra. In fact, Elvis would go and see his dad play as a kid. In fact, those would be his first gigs.
I went to the Hammersmith Palais when I was a kid to watch him on a Saturday afternoon, and he didn't really sing much because it was mainly competition dancers practicing, and competition dancers don't like singers because they pull the beat around when they phrase, you know. They like the strict tempo because they're counting their steps.
Yeah.
And there would be little old ladies dancing together and mothers teaching their daughters. You know, it was a dance hall opening up for maybe 30 patrons, you know, and me up in a totally deserted balcony watching music. So that's sort of a curious introduction to it. And I went to broadcasts during the 1960s on school holidays at the Playhouse Theatre in Charing Cross. The Joe Loss Orchestra had their Friday lunchtime pop show. And that's the first time I ever saw people from groups whose records I had up close, because they had guest artists, and the guest artists were the people in the charts. So some week it could be you know, the Hollies, or, you know, groups that I really liked, and I got to see them carry their gear in, and, you know, probably having driven overnight from Huddersfield or somewhere, you know, you don't know where they, you know, and that, well, later on I kind of realised that was the life that they were obviously living. It seemed very glamorous. It was a strange kind of, I separated out the groups that I, you know, I admired to the fact that it was my dad up there. I was still proud of him, but they were clearly a different generation, the musicians in the orchestra, you know.
Who were your first musical obsessions that were yours, that you kind of discovered, the earliest ones you kind of remember?
Probably, Georgie Fame, actually. Georgie Fame.
Nice.
The first EP I ever owned after Twist and Shout was Fame at Last. And that's a very good crash course in all sorts of music, because it has one Ray Charles song on it, one Lambert Hendricks and Ross song, a Goffin and King song, and a Mose Allison song, which was written by Willie Dixon. So it was great. I love the life I live. Give me that wine. Get on the right track, baby, and point of no return. It's kind of a crash course in everything that's good.
Get on the right track, baby. Get on the right track, baby. Get on the right track, baby. Come on home and treat me round again. Get on the right track, baby. Get on the right track, baby. Get on the right track, baby. This time, girl, come right on home. Treat me wrong again. Don't you know that I love you, baby? And I've crammed both night and day. But I'll tell you just one more time. Come back even if you don't stay. Get on the right track, baby. Get on the right track, baby. Get on the right track, baby. You better look out, girl, come right on home. Treat me wrong again, what I want. Don't you know that I love you, baby? But yet you broke my heart in two. Please, please come back home. I wanna spend my life with you. Get on the right track. That's what I want. Get on the right track. That's what I said. Get on the right track. You better look out, girl. Come on home. Treat me wrong one more time. You better believe that I'm in love with you, baby. Don't you know you broke my heart in two? Please, 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 please come back home. I'm feeling low down and blue. Get on the right track. What'd I say? Get on the right track. What'd I say? Get on the right track. This damn girl, come right on home, baby. Why don't you treat me wrong? You better look out, baby.
I love Georgie Fame, and he was terrific right through the 60s. Small Faces, that was like the other group that I liked. And then when Motown appeared, I remember the Motown artists, there was a few records that had filtered through, and they called it Tamla then. They didn't call it Motown. Everybody misremembers it. We always called it Tamla. They came over and did a special on Ready, Steady, Go, and it was the first time I think anybody had seen groups like that doing those coordinated steps and incredible outfits and
super tight band.
Yeah, I think they were probably lip syncing, but I didn't even think about that. It was all miming then. I'm sure it was. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't. It sounded great anyway. We didn't care. We were seeing them, you know. And those records, I did start to spend pocket money on buying, records. If my dad didn't get detailed that song to sing, they didn't do all of the hits I liked, the Marvin Gaye things and Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell.
What about your first gig that you performed at? Can you remember that? Who did you want to be on stage?
I don't know. I wasn't very old. I don't know, it was about 1969. It was in a church basement in Richmond. I was a floor singer at a folk club. Ewan McColl was the headliner.
Wow.
Well, I would say headliner. He was the act in that night, the paid act. And a bunch of people played who just wanted to play the guitar. I went on. I was given two songs, I think, in the first half. Ewan McColl was asleep in the front row through my songs. And it was a bit of a chastening experience, but,
What were the songs?
Oh, the songs I wrote.
So you're doing your own stuff very early on.
Yeah. I don't know what age I was. Whatever age I was I'm born in August, so I could have been 15.
Calling Mr. Ozzel with a swastika tattoo. There is a vacancy waiting in the English voodoo. Carver beef for metal on the filter bar's head. When it's had enough for that, maybe you'll take him to bed to keep him he's alive, or he wishes he was dead. Turn up the TV, no one listening will suspect, even your mother won't detect it, so your father won't know. They think that I got no respect, but everything means less than zero. They got the finest home movies that you have ever seen. They got a thousand variations, every service with a smile. They're gonna take a little break and they'll be back after a while. Well, I hear the South America is coming in a style. Turn up the TV, the one with some will suspect, even your mother won't detect it, so your father won't. Smoking, a manly on the floor. Mr. Oswald said he had an understanding with the law. He said he heard about a couple living in the USA. He said they traded and they baited for a Chevrolet. Said, talk about the future, now we put that past away.
Your first album as Elvis Costello, which was Miami's True, that's a pretty powerful statement of intent right from the off, isn't it? It's a pretty strong collection of songs, let's be honest.
Well, I didn't know anything different. I'd written all sorts of different songs and I'd had sort of, try to learn from the people I loved, same as everybody does. You copy something, and I hear old tapes that predate Miami's True. some of which came to light only recently, some of which have songs that have never been heard before, and where I sound, obviously, I sort of sound like one, I'm sounding like somebody, one, somebody else, you know. And then a few sort of early versions of lyrics that I use later, I must have gone back to my notebooks, I'd almost forgotten that I'd done this, that I had to kind of rework songs, even in that very, you know, in that first period between like 75 and 77. But once I got the kind of sound from the first demos,
found your voice, I suppose.
There was only one song on the demo tape that got me through the door at Stiff that we ended up recording.
Really? That's interesting.
It was Mystery Dance, yeah. And then once I heard the recording with Clover, who were a band that had come over from California to make their name in London, exactly when being able to play your instrument was kind of going out of style, you know. You know, they were great musicians, but there was a distance between what I was hearing and what I could convey to them. And it was almost like they were too good. And,
can you just learn a bit less?
Yeah, but that didn't afflict the attractions. You know, that when once we assembled that group in the summer of 77, they understood like how to be accomplished and leave stuff out. You know, that we didn't try to be always displaying everything that we could do. Steve was obviously classically trained, so he had a lot of facility. And Bruce Thomas was an incredible, you know, like melodic bass player. And Pete, you know, had tremendous energy, and I was kind of the other rhythm element, you know. I didn't really play solos early on at all. And that kind of combination worked very well for a number of years, and it served us even through quite a few transitions in the writing, you know. I mean, every form of music that you play is a kind of collaboration. It's an agreement between those four musicians. It's less notable when it's, you know, when you're not sort of exchanging ideas with another songwriter or music from a completely different world of music or methodology or performance practice, you know, if you're suddenly sort of playing acoustic instruments or playing with strings or something, you know.
Oh, it's so funny to be seeing you after so long, girl. And with the way you look, I understand that you were not impressed. But I heard you let that little friend of mine take off your party dress. I'm not gonna get too sentimental like those other sticker valentines. Cause I don't know if you are loving somebody, I only know it isn't mine. Allison, I know this world is killing you. Oh, Allison, my aim is true. Got a husband now. Did you leave your pretty fingers lying in the wedding cake? You used to hold him right in your hand. I bet it took all he could take. Sometimes I wish that I could stop you from talking when I hear the silly things that you say. Cause I can't stand to see you this way. Allison, I know this world is killing you. Oh, Allison, my aim is true.
Tell me about Joni Mitchell, because that's someone you've always loved. When did you first hear her and kind of... when did she first speak to you?
The first album my father gave to me. Somebody had given it to him, and he liked it and thought I should hear it, and kind of lent it to me, and I never gave it back. And
What is it about Joni that you love so much?
She was really fairly unprecedented songwriter. You know, I mean, even early on, I didn't understand everything. I knew the guitar. When I tried to copy it, I couldn't play any of those chords she was playing. And then I read that they were all open tunings, and I thought, there's something very strange. And then as it went on, you know, each record was developed it more and more. Blue was very shocking. You know, I suppose it was about 18 when that record came out. Maybe it wasn't quite 18, 17.
It's a good age for that record.
But it was a perfect time to hear it, you know, because it was sort of describing an emotional world that you weren't quite within, but you knew enough of. It's almost aspired to, you know, being in love to that kind of torturing degree. And maybe you had kind of had some inkling of what that was or what it could turn into. And then I loved her. I mean, I think all of the... she's hardly made a record that doesn't have something to interest you. I mean, there are some that I like more than others. But she's a very interesting person to encounter. I met her a few times. In fact, I interviewed her at great length for Vanity Fair for about 6 hours. It was a very extraordinary conversation. You know?
Wow.
Yeah, so it was... yeah.
Was Joni Mitchell with California, recorded live at the BBC Paris Theatre in 1970. A huge influence on my guest today on the first time, Mr. Elvis Costello.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio Six Music.
Oh, I just don't know where to begin. Though it says I'll wait forever, it's now or never, but she keeps on hanging on. The silver chamber on.
Just to be a victim, now you're not the only one. Accidents will happen, we're all in
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome back to The First Time here on Six Music, the show where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Elvis Costello, and that is Elvis with Accidents Will Happen from his 1979 album Armed Forces. As a musician, Elvis has always experimented with different genres, changing styles from album to album, but the world of jazz has always been something he's returned to. His father was a jazz trumpeter, and he often collaborates with jazz musicians.
The trumpet is the family business, and I was the one that didn't go into it. It's like coming from a line of doctors. You know, my grandfather and father were trumpet players, so I sort of really failed in that, in not learning it. I mean, like everybody, I love the Prestige records, I love all of the great Columbia records, from the Gil Evans collaborations and Kind of Blue to the Electric records. I mean, there's nothing more to say about it, really. I also sort of very much loved musicians who were obviously, their sound was sort of influenced by Miles Davis, like Chet Baker. Obviously, he took a model of a particular part of Miles Davis's output and then made a whole sound out of it. And we did work together, and I mean, that was very amazing.
What was he like?
He was a difficult man to get to know, but he was actually very open. I mean, he was playing with very little support. You know, he didn't have anybody around him. He was playing in London when we were recording Punch the Clock. Clive Langer and I had written Shipbuilding the year before for Robert Wyatt, and Steve Naive had played on Robert's recording. So when we came to record the song for a sort of international release, because Robert's version wasn't really issued in America, we came to re-record the song. I had the idea of a trumpet solo, and just when we were in discussion about who might take that role, or who we could even approach, who we dare approach, Chet Baker was suddenly playing a barely announced gig in Covent Garden, and I just went to the club and sort of asked him to play on our record. It was amazing, you know. He had no boundary, you know. He had no sort of, well, oh no, I have to ask my manager. Is it, yeah.
Just a rumor that was spread around town by the women and children. Soon we'll be shipbuilding. Well, I ask you, the boy said, Dad, they're going to take me to task, but I'll be by Christmas. It's just a rumor that was spread around town. Somebody said that someone got killed in, for saying that people get killed in, the result of this ship building.
we could be diving for pearls.
Because shipbuilding has become one of these songs. It happens with some songs, they kind of belong to everybody now, and they mean
nice
so much
of you to
people.
Say. Well, I mean, I was quite. I did hear a documentary that was made about it, and obviously, I thought it was great that Clive was interviewed. You know, because sometimes it gets overlooked that I would just be up there reciting something if it wasn't for this great tune. You know. But I was amazed by all the different points of view about the song and what it had meant to people. You've got to be affected by that when you write a song that it has any kind of endurance. And I've been fortunate enough to have songs that have that quality. And when it's a song that was triggered by one set of like events, and you can find common ground with the repeated folly of war, it gives you a reason to keep singing the song, you know, and it even sort of pointed the way in some respects to some of the lyrics on Wise Up Ghost on the new record, in that it was perhaps people talking and asking me about shipbuilding as if I hadn't written any songs of comment in the interim, but they just hadn't resonated in the same degree. I mean, there are plenty of songs that I've written in the interim that weren't. I took issue with it sometimes when people would say blindly, well, he walked away from political comment, or as if I didn't have any conscience about anything. I could point at dozens of songs in the 20, 30 years since that song was written. Just because you didn't hear them, that doesn't make me a failure. It makes me a failure as a commercial artist to get it to the broadest public, but as a songwriter, I stand by the words and the music of these particular songs. And in this case, sometimes they've been the foundation of a new piece now with new music.
Can you tell me about meeting Burt Bacharach for the first time? Because God Give Me Strength is probably my favourite song of yours. It's an incredible tune.
Yeah, well, it's we worked together first in the writing of God Give Me Strength, and we did that unbelievably over fax and answer machine. We weren't in the room together when we wrote it. We wrote it in, oddly enough, in this sort of like a long distance dialogue that much of the record with the Roots was made, so I know that methodology can be very productive. We had met briefly about 5 years earlier in a studio in Los Angeles, and he was just a very, very genial, and as we got to know one another more, we did spend a lot of time around a piano or two pianos writing music together, something I realize now that he had not done very much. And I was writing the lyrics for him, and we continue to write. And we're now working on a stage musical adaptation of A Painting from Memory, which requires us, in order to make the story take credible turns, to write, you know, six or seven new songs, which is fantastic to be working with him again, because the drive, and it's his urgency about it, which is even spurring me on.
So God, give me strength, 'cause I'm weak in a way. And if I'm strong, I might still break. And I don't have anything to shed, but I won't throw away into the air. That song is sung yet. This bell is rung out. She was the light that I'd bless. She took my last chance of happiness. So God, give me strength. God, if you'd grant me her indulgence and decline, I might as well wipe her from my memory. Washed out like a lip print on his shirt. See, I'm only human. I want him to hurt. I want him. I want him to hurt. The power to pretend that there could ever be a happy ending. That song is sung out. This bell is rung out. She was the light that I took my last chance of happiness. So God, give me strength. God, give me strength.
About first meeting Paul McCartney.
We played with Paul on the Last Wing show and the Campuchia Benefits in 1980. That was the first time I think we actually met.
How was it meeting him?
Well, I mean, he was just great. He and Linda were just fantastic. It was like, I didn't know that the Wings thing was coming to an end. Nobody really did. It wasn't said. I think that was their last show. He was making records under just his name after that. And we were in adjacent studios for the next couple of years when he was making Pipes of Peace, using the same engineer, Jeff Emmerich. So he was working, moving between our projects and Paul's.
Amazing.
So, you know, I mean, our paths crossed. I knew, I mean, now I'm friends with Mary and Stella, but you know, they were young girls then, you know, and family was there, and he was just always very at ease.
Very right,
and,
yeah.
And then when I had the opportunity to write with him, we wrote really quickly, a dozen songs over a couple of sessions over a couple of years, some of which have never been recorded and issued, and there are some really beautiful songs.
Record them, come on.
Yeah, well, we will. I mean, then my wife ended up kind of playing piano on his last record, so we have seen one another more recently, you know, and I think, I mean, you see his show, it's just a remarkable thing.
Is it all in that pretty little head of yours? What goes on in that place in the dark? Well, I used to know a girl and I could have sworn that her name was Veronica. To have a carefree mind of her own and a delicate look in her eyes. These days I'm afraid she's not even sure if her name is Veronica.
So finally, when did you first meet the Roots? What was the first contact that you had that led to this?
Well, I mean, they play nightly on the Jimmy Fallon show, and I've made three appearances on the show, and a methodology for... We didn't know what we were doing at the time. We discovered how we would arrange music together in a very unselfconscious way, how we could use the example of one record to energize and a new piece of music. They obviously had in the back of their mind a scheme that we might work together, and without any plan, without any notice to a record company, we started to exchange ideas, and we went from making one piece to two pieces to five pieces to, you know, next thing we knew we had 20 pieces, and then it was a question of deciding which things we were going to complete, putting the musical ideas, drawing from the talents of the Roots, but mainly being a three-part dialogue between Questlove and myself, with Stephen Mandel, the other producer, in the middle, sort of identifying the worth of the different perspectives and putting all of the sound under pressure in the middle and squeezing it all up and twisting those dials to yield the sound that we have.
You seem to be taking quite a lot of glee in the way this came about, so undercover. So
well, it was great because I think we didn't have any preconceived ideas ourselves. We didn't have any big philosophical chat about it. Just a few words passed between us, and we started making music. And we didn't tell any record company, because they have a record label, but I currently wasn't signed to anybody, so I had the freedom to do what I wanted. And we've been fortunate to find a home in Blue Note, people who are very sympathetic to what we've made. And that's much better for their enthusiasm to be brand new than to have a contract that says, hey, we need a record from you today, what have you got? They're actually hearing this record, they know which one they're getting, Wise Up Ghost.
What's the song that we should finish with? Choice of yours. It can be anything. Old, new, off this record, or something you heard this morning.
I think we should play Stick Out Your Tongue.
Why that one?
Well, I think it'll be intrigue people because it's a starting point of the record, making of this record, in that it was we decided to look at cutting Pills and Soap Again, a song I wrote 30 years ago, with newly placed lyrics, a collage of lyrics. So even I would play this one to intrigue people ahead of even songs that are brand new.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Wanna join in a chorus? Saudi Ho Chi Minh City. Kitty say Papa, 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 Papa Sam, take me home. See me got photo, photo, photograph of you and Mama, Mama, Mama Sam, of you and Mama, Mama, Mama Sam. Let me tell you about your blood bamboo kid.
It ain't Coca-Cola, it's rice.
Straight to hell, boy. Go straight to hell, boy. Go straight to hell, boy. Go straight to hell, boy. Oh, Papa Sam, please take me home. Oh, Papa Sam, everybody, they wanna go home. So Mama Sam says, banjo on the druggy drag ragtime USA in Parkland International. Hey, junkie dumb USA, where pro cane proves the purest rock man groove and rat poison. The volatile Molotov says, it up loud and strong. The immigrants, they wanna sing all night long. It could be anywhere, most likely could be any frontier, any hemisphere. No man's land.
BBC Radio 6 Music. Right now.
This is the Morning After Mix.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.
It's raining today, and I'm just about to forget the train window girl that wonderful day we met. She smiles through the smoke.